The rise of an American Jewish intelligentsia began with the influx of Jewish immigrants who crowded into New York at the turn of the 19th century, bringing many young people with ambitions of becoming writers and creative thinkers, as was natural for a people that ascribed the highest value to intellectual activity. The newspaper was itself a hybrid form of information and entertainment, commerce and ideology, persuasion and accommodation, individual expression for the mass market. The Yiddish newspaper had further to negotiate between the European past and the American present, between staying Jewish and becoming American. We were speaking about some of the Yiddish intellectuals. And today I'm going to be speaking of one of two people who kind of go together, Maurice Sirkin and Maurice Samuel. And I think that you'll see why. I would begin by saying that they could have been the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers of the American Jewish intelligentsia. And one is very sorry that they did not become that. So Maurice Samuel was 20 years old, and Maurice Sirkin was a precocious 16 when they fell in love in the summer of 1915. She was getting over the recent death of her mother, who was an activist in the Russian revolutionary struggle for Jewish and women's rights. And her grieving father, Nachman Sirkin, felt that their daughter would be better off at a vacation hotel on the Jersey Shore that belonged to one of his many acquaintances. So Maurice had arrived from England not long before, and he was trying to establish himself in New York City, but he had accompanied a friend to the Atlantic Hotel where she was staying and invited this lovely young lady for a stroll along the boardwalk. Now, it would be hard to imagine a better matched pair. Both were intensely literary. He, by then, advanced enough to dazzle her with his command of the poems that she knew. Both were European-born and intensely Jewish, without adhering to any formal religious observance. Circumstance had made them independent, very, and free to form attachments, though, as we shall see, only up to a point. When he returned to the city, their friendship continued through correspondence, she imploring him to come and visit her, he explaining why he would like to, but could not always jump at the chance. So since they both already considered themselves writers, the separation spiked rather than cooled their romance. Their letters, many of which are preserved, alternately playful and reproachful, were hungry for reassurance of reciprocal affection. But they never became that team. When America entered the war in Europe, although Maurice had come to the United States in order, I mean, at least partly or largely to avoid being drafted into the British Army, he enlisted here in America, and he was soon called up for basic training, followed by overseas service. He and Marie arranged a civil ceremony and consummated their marriage, but her father had it annulled. And although she never forgave him, neither did she defy him. So this may well have remained the strongest romantic attachment of their lives. Yet they married others and came together again only intermittently, sometimes still trying to reconstruct what had gone wrong. One is left to wonder what they might have accomplished if they had remained a couple. But separately, they became two of the most effective Jewish thinkers of their time, oracles of American Zionism, in the very spirit of the man who had kept them apart. Now, Nachman Sirkin was one of the leaders of the Zionist movement that Theodor Herzl founded in Basel in 1897. And the year after Herzl published The Jewish State, arguing for the return of Jews to their eternal homeland, Nachman Sirkin countered with a pamphlet called The Jewish Problem and the Jewish Socialist State, insisting that the national ideal be combined with the presumably greater international ideal of economic justice. Now, the main schism at the time among young Jews who wanted to live Jewishly without religious observance was between Zionists, who sought national independence in the land of Israel, and socialists, who advocated a Marxist-inspired liberation of the Jews as part of the international proletariat. Rather than accept this dichotomy, Sirkin's synthesis sought to have a Jewish state that would be guided by, quote, justice, rational planning, and social solidarity, unquote. The labor Zionism he championed insisted that only by fusing with socialism can Zionism become the ideal of the whole Jewish people, of the proletariat, the middle class, and the intelligentsia, his definition of the whole Jewish people. Right. So in the same way that Jewish rabbinic families raised the cleverest of their sons to become rabbis, the Sirkins raised their exceptional daughter for political leadership. They taught her the main languages of Europe and shared with her their adult concerns. Having moved with her parents through four countries, on arrival in the United States at the age of six, Marie was young enough to embrace English and the Anglo-American culture as her own, but with an indelible European, Jewish, and specifically labor Zionist imprint. Nachman may have thought that he was acting in her best interests when he dissolved her marriage to Maurice Samuel, doubting the unproven younger man's ability to provide adequately for his daughter. He could do nothing, however, to prevent her second marriage to Aaron Bodansky, a lecturer in chemistry at Cornell, that dissolved on its own after several years, by which time her father was no longer alive to comfort or guide her. Marie was 25 years old when he died in 1924. In recognition of his contribution to the establishment of Israel, his remains were later buried alongside other labor Zionist founders in Kibbutz Kinneret. Now, Marie's striking good looks, I don't think I exaggerate, and literary intellectual talent led to a series of romantic involvements with a succession of impressive men of letters. Her devoted biographer, Carol Kessler, who has written really a very fine biography of her, closely covers her subject's private life, Marie's marriages, the child that she lost to illness, and the son that she raised, and her third marriage to the poet Charles Reznikoff, which allowed each of them maximal freedom within a relatively compatible, enduring partnership. Writing from a feminist perspective, Kessler highlights some of her subject's thwarted literary ambitions, especially in the years while she was working as a school teacher and navigating a series of unsteady domestic arrangements. Marie failed to complete her PhD in literature at Cornell and did not publish her own book of poetry until 1979. Yet if some of her ambition remained unfulfilled, it was not only because of her maternal and marital obligations, I think. It was because, like Maurice Samuel, she devoted much of her intellectual and literary energy to the Zionist struggle, which encompassed and transcended some of their competing literary ambitions, although they did, by the way, write a great deal, and he especially. Now, Marie Sirkin was so talented that we can consider some of the things that she did not become. She was an almost exact contemporary of Golda Meirson, later Meir, who was brought by her parents to America in 1906, same time as Marie Sirkin, and likewise became active in the labor Zionist movement. Unlike Golda, Marie did not immigrate to Palestine to become prime minister of the State of Israel. She was much impressed when she began to meet Golda during her fundraising trips to America. In 1932 was, I think, one of them, and later she became Golda's speechwriter, her friend, and biographer, but she remained a persuader through writing. And though she was always being asked about it, she did not make Aliyah. Hebrew was not among her languages, and despite repeated efforts to master the language, she felt that her lack of fluency may have been one of the reasons that she never chose to settle where she would not have been in command of her medium. What she did instead was to chart the new literary reality that was coming into being. Zionist theorists like her father had done their work, but now that Israel was being developed and determining how it could be governed, reliable accounts of what was being accomplished there was pretty much as important as the pioneering songs and inspirational speeches that others were making. Marie became a historian in real time, a journalist, an excellent journalist, who realized that she was witnessing and recording transformative events in the life of the Jewish people. With contemporaries, and some of those that we spoke about in the previous series, which were later, and better known New York intellectuals, with them beginning to launch American literary and academic careers that would bring them fame, wealth, and Nobel Prizes, she threw herself into active Zionism at the higher task. Marie made her first trip to Palestine shortly after Hitler was installed as Chancellor of Germany, putting the state of the Jews at the head of her priorities, where it stayed for the rest of her life. The Sirkin name, and she was, this was royalty within the Zionist movement, and her almost native English gave Marie an insider-outsider journalist's advantage in covering all Zionist affairs. On that first 1934 trip to Palestine, she describes a Passover Seder at Kibbutz Ein Harod. Her account of the indifferent food and the buzzing flies evoke the harsh conditions of a settlement that is still busy draining the swamps and clearing the rocks in the earliest stages of agricultural development. Now, having never attended a traditional Seder, she is happy to comment on the way kibbutz members adapt the Haggadah to their ideological emphasis on socialist equality. The Seder's climax is a tireless horah, emblem of the pioneering spirit. This is all her account, right? Marie freshly discovers what was eventually to become a cliché, the way the early Zionist spirit overcame the challenging environment, just as the faith of religious Jews had helped them transcend the harsh conditions of the diaspora. Sometimes her writing is discredited as romanticism, but her reporting turns out to have been, if anything, an understated account of how the Jews of Palestine built a resilient state. She was a trusted liaison between events in Palestine and the otherwise preoccupied Jews of North America. Now, her reportage began to appear in the Jewish Frontier, the English language monthly launched by the labor Zionist movement in 1934, when its editor Chaim Greenberg realized that its Yiddish publication, Der Yiddischer Kämpfer, the Jewish militant, could not reach the younger generation. The Yiddish newspaper, as Abraham Kahn conceived it, reinforced the national cohesion of American Jewry by Americanizing them through their native Jewish medium, through the Yiddish language. And for as long as it lasted, the Yiddish press served that purpose. But immigrant Jews were adapting to English faster than other minorities, and Marie herself never published other than in English. Charles Reznikoff, whom Marie married in 1930, would later write a fictional autobiography, Family Chronicle, about the adjustment of Russian Jewish immigrant parents to America. And this includes a telling scene, it's a scene I love, where here it is his mother who is speaking. And she says, "My husband was still reading a Yiddish newspaper. 'You will never learn English if you do that,' I said. But he kept on. At last I said, 'If you bring a Yiddish newspaper home again, I'll tear it up.' Next night, he brought his newspaper with him and after supper, settled down to read. I snatched it out of his hands and tore it to bits. He was furious, of course. 'I'll do it again,' I said, but I did not have to. The very next night, he had an English newspaper and soon knew more English than I. So it was this rapid, and in this case violent, swing of immigrant Jews to English that induced Chaim Greenberg, the editor of the Yiddisher Kempfer, to establish this new English magazine. Marie joined the staff as its youngest and probably most fluent English reader and writer, and steadily rose in its ranks to become the editor-in-chief from 1948 to 1973. Now, the magazine declared that its purpose was to unite all Friends of Labor Palestine into an organized active force for the support of the vanguard of the Chalutzim movement, of the pioneering movement, the Histadrut HaOvdim, the General Jewish Federation of Labor in Palestine, in all its activities, which aim at the building of the Jewish national home in Palestine on a foundation of free, creative labor and the creation therein of a cooperative commonwealth of labor. Now, you see that this segue from Friends into active force, culminating in that cooperative commonwealth of labor, reflects exactly the way David Ben-Gurion in Palestine was using the Histadrut as nucleus of a government in formation. And since labor Zionism was then the strongest faction of the Zionist movement, contributors to the magazine could feel that they were the intellectual cultural force defining the emerging Jewish state. But Jewish Frontier became much more than a political house organ. As free-ranging intellectuals in the vaunted tradition of Jewish debate, the contributors often preferred cultural to practical discussions. So Marie now had an outlet for every kind of writing, from poetry to polemics, and she published those and anything that she cared to write about, basically. Authoritatively at home in the Jewish world, but no less conversant with what was happening in the surrounding intellectual circles, she was able to correct anti-Zionist opinion and propaganda in the leftist magazines where most of her fellow Jewish intellectuals were publishing. You may say, listening to this, Marie, Marie, where art thou now? No change. When a correspondent in The Nation accused the Jews of Palestine of being a threat to the Arabs, the kind of accusation that has never stopped from that time to this, she responds that there is no such danger of the Jew displacing the Arab worker. Ben-Gurion and the Yishuv were determined to prevent exploitation of the Jewish Arab laboring class. She writes, Zionism is based on the belief, now borne out by experience, that with the introduction of modern methods of intensive agriculture, Palestine can support a much larger population, Jewish and Arab, than it does at present. Jewish colonization is not only reclaiming a barren land, but increasing its absorptive capacity. The growth of the Jewish population is accompanied by a steady increase of the Arab population, as well as an improvement in its standard of living, and so on. Now, liberal Jews like herself, who embraced Zionism, had to oppose not only the anti-Semites, but also socialist internationalists, including many Jews, who opposed Zionism with arguments against its practicality, against its morality, and against its political, and outlining its political perils. Defending Jewish nationhood made her a better judge than they of political reality. And this is a point I think that we'll see. And next time, I think we'll see how closely her perspective resembled that of Maurice Samuel, writing sometimes in tandem about the very same subjects from very similar perspectives. So given their Russian provenance, the editors of Jewish Frontier also kept close watch on the evolution of socialism in the Soviet Union. Joseph Stalin's Reign of Terror was being denied by communists and fellow travelers who were determined to defend him from any accusation of wrongdoing. Walter Duranty of the New York Times knowingly kept the truth of Soviet crimes from the American public. When reports of the trials of former Bolshevik leaders began to leak through the conspiracy of silence, the belief in Stalin as the only credible bulwark against the fascist threat further inhibited some Jews from admitting the truth, but not the people on the Jewish frontier. In 1937, Marie Sirkin wrote a definitive exposé of the corrupt Moscow trials. This may not sound like much to you, but in its time, this was really a breakthrough. Others were not doing it. So she writes, after reading the nearly 600 pages of stenographic report of the January Moscow trial, one begins to understand why many correspondents like Walter Duranty wrote home that the testimony rang true. The grotesque accusations, the incredible self-flagellation of the defendants, which stood out in such naked relief in the brief news dispatches, are submerged by the flood of detail, dates, meetings, descriptions of specific localities, reports of conversations. The sheer volume of trivial and significant incidents have an inherent persuasiveness, irrespective of accuracy. The most fabulous plot seems a little far-fetched if we announce that it was hatched at Child's on Broadway, and if we describe the buckwheat cakes that the plotters ate, right? So some of the reality of the maple syrup clings to the story. So she uses all the critical skills that she had developed in her study of literature, suggesting why correspondents like Duranty may have believed the defendants' testimonies, despite the obvious fact that the confessions of treason on such a colossal scale were preposterous, a riddle of human behavior. Lacking any hard evidence to prove the falsity of the trials, you understand her predicament. She had no access to the actual information. She had only these texts. So lacking any hard evidence, she appeals to the sanity of the reader as the arbiter of truth. How could all of Lenin's closest associates and collaborators be implicated and all their villainy be attributed to Leon Trotsky? The variety of fantastic explanations offered for the confessions is itself evidence of their well-nigh incredible character. A baffled world turns to Oriental drugs, hypnosis, and the mystical Dostoevsky soul for light on this nightmare. Either the Bolshevik Revolution was brought into being almost exclusively by a rogues gallery of psychopaths and degenerates, or the trial is a frame-up. So, Sirkin's warning that dictatorship and political repression are fatal means, no matter how noble the end, drew from Sidney Hook, who was America's leading authority on Marxism, praise for an article that he says is as rare as it is impressive, of objective, logical analysis of a complicated political situation. And Hook, by the way, he was the one who was then launching the American Committee for the Defense of Leon Trotsky. And it was he who so welcomed this ally, this Zionist ally, in the anti-communist front. Now, it was literature that was Marie's chosen profession. A prolific book reviewer, she was one of the first to recognize that Henry Roth's novel, Call It Sleep, which was later hailed as an American classic, though not a pleasant book, was the work of a major novelist who could both create characters with an independent life and infuse his prose with a moody, lyric passion, her words. But her scathing review of Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint, written three decades later, broke with the adoring reception that the book was receiving, and the sharpness of her criticism may have added to the book's notoriety. She objects not primarily to its superficiality, because, quote, you cannot judge Al Capp by Rembrandt. Al Capp was then one of the most famous cartoonists. And she wrote, you don't object to Philip Roth because he is a cartoonist, but to what lies behind the cartoon. She writes, within the trappings of the old hat Jewish joke lurks a savage anti-Jewish stereotype, even more old hat and not all that funny. She expected the American Jewish writer to reverse the cultural decline rather than descend to its level. Roth used her disapproval and that of Irving Howe to promote the degree to which he was a rebel against conservative elders. Now, what may have seemed a generation gap between these two was actually a long-standing disparity between intellectuals like Marie, who lived at the heart of the Jewish people, and those who, without their Jewishness, without ever denying their Jewishness, and while often exploiting its literary potential, assumed no responsibility for the Jewish future. These thinkers who prided themselves on their alienation considered themselves more cosmopolitan than the parochial Zionists. Yet the Zionist intellectual, forced to keep her eye on every threat, saw the dangers of the international situation much more clearly. Only once did her publication, Jewish Frontier, briefly hesitate on being told in August 1942 that Hitler intended to exterminate all the Jews of Europe according to a plan that was already being implemented. Unable to assimilate this information, they buried news of the report at the back of their September issue. Years later, Marie explained that American Jews, like the Jews in Europe's ghettos, could not believe what they were told. But it took only 1 month before the magazine not only published the report, but from then on kept it at the front of their concerns. And they were the first, right, to bring this into public attention. Reporting on the Yishuv in Palestine clearly merged with coverage of the war in Europe, and the two came together in the work for which Marie Sirkin is best known, Blessed is the Match, the story of Jewish resistance. And by the way, I commend it to you. This is a book that I read as a teenager, my daughter read as a teenager. But it's not meant for teenagers. It's just a phenomenal book that wears pretty well. She writes, in the fall of 1945, immediately upon the conclusion of World War II, I left for Palestine on the SS Gripsholm, the first ship from New York to sail for the Middle East with civilians since the outbreak of hostilities in 1939. My purpose was to interview survivors of the death camps and participants in the Jewish resistance, who at that time were to be found primarily in Palestine. Blessed is the Match, was the result of that voyage. So even as others dealt with grief and disclosure of the horrors that had been hidden from view, Marie went after the aspect of Jewish life that she knew best, its fighting strength, the bravery of those who were part of a venture infinitely larger than themselves. She marshals the evidence of Jewish fighting strength, beginning with Hannah Senish, one of the immigrants to Palestine who parachuted back into their part of Nazi-occupied Europe, in her case it was Hungary, in order to establish a route of escape. Dropped into her native Hungary, Hannah was captured and executed after being tortured without having revealed the purpose of her mission. Israelis called her their Joan of Arc. A budding writer, Hannah had written the poem that became her epitaph and in Marie Sirkin's translation, the essence of her book. Blessed is the match that is consumed in kindling flame. Blessed is the flame that burns in the secret fastness of the heart. Blessed is the heart with strength to stop its beating for honor's sake. Blessed is the match that is consumed in kindling flame. Now, this was not an ideal of self-sacrifice for its own sake, but the kindling that inspires the recovery of the nation. Marie followed up the story of Hannah Senish with reports of Jewish partisan resistance movements, the Warsaw Ghetto uprising that lasted longer than the French Maginot Line. She interviews resistance fighters in Holland, partisans of the Lithuanian forests. Against the charge the Jews of Israel had ignored those in Europe, we learn of the amazing operations undertaken by members of the Yishuv, the Jewish community of Palestine, who were themselves under siege in rescue operations throughout Europe and Turkey. Against the charge the Jews had gone like sheep to the slaughter, we learn about those who had used that phrase, do not go like sheep to the slaughter, not to condemn Jewish passivity, but to awaken Jewish defiance. Vivid parts of the book occur when Marie is struggling over how to present the material. She asks one of the ghetto fighters, a young woman, how can one understand the mothers who choked their children? Did they do it to survive themselves or because of those in the bunker with them? The girl tries to explain, but when the questioning continues, the girl replies, you see, you don't understand. Of course, the normal mothers died. You ask me of exceptions. They were the weak, the crazy, the bad. The best perished. You will never know how wonderful they were. This too you will never understand. So wherever possible, Marie gives us the voices of those remarkable people speaking for themselves. How else but through such narratives try to convey the incomprehensible? But Marie Sirkin ends the book as she began, with the post-war illegal immigration to Palestine known as the Ha'apalah, and the arrival of one of the small ships, an Italian boat, called the Hannah Senish. She brings us the bold speech that the Italian captain made, praising those on shore. You too have the right to be a small, independent people along the large Mediterranean, which should be a quiet sea. And she translates the poem that Natan Alterman, one of the greatest Hebrew poets in Palestine at the time, the poem that he wrote to the captain extolling the way they escaped the British blockade. The poem was banned by the British censor, but that only increased its fame. Now, reading Marie's accounts of Jewish resistance, one better understands her entry into the post-war debate among American Jewish intellectuals over Hannah Arendt's coverage of the Jerusalem trial of Adolf Eichmann in 1961. Hannah Arendt had arrived in New York as a German Jewish refugee in 1941. She was soon at the adoring center of the Jewish intellectual community that was more than a little dazzled by the aura of this woman thinker who had studied under renowned German philosopher Martin Heidegger. When Arendt learned of the Eichmann trial, she sidestepped the small magazines where she usually published, and she offered her services to the larger circulation New Yorker. And the resulting coverage of the book, that she published this in the New Yorker and then in a book which with the subtitle, The Banality of Evil, and that triggered the controversy that she had obviously intended to provoke. Now, Hannah Arendt's book is worth reading, if only to better appreciate Marie Sirkin's evisceration of it. Among the disturbing features were Hannah Arendt's contempt for David Ben-Gurion, whom she accused of politicizing the trial. She speaks of him exactly the way people accuse Benjamin Netanyahu nowadays. There is also her uninformed accusation of the Jewish councils in the ghettos for allegedly aiding the Nazis in their work, and most of all, her characterization of the accused, Adolf Eichmann, as the robotic product of totalitarianism, not really able to fully distinguish good from evil because of this sort of totalitarian mindset, which really changes evil to just a kind of banality, right? Just orders. So Hannah Arendt's coverage angered many of her former admirers, Norman Podhoretz calling it a display of the perversity of brilliance, and Irving Howe, as editor of the magazine Dissent, organized a public debate which was attended by hundreds, to which Marie and Lionel Abel spoke against the book. Jews who had themselves ignored what was happening in Europe and Palestine were shocked by Arendt's attacks and by her misrepresentations. With prosecutorial skill, Marie exposed points of ignorance, omissions, and distortions in Hannah Arendt's reportage, which she called high-handed manipulation of material to suit her purpose and disregard of whatever does not suit her thesis. And of course, Sirkin is able to bring information that she had gathered from witnesses immediately after the war and from dedicated historians like Jacob Robinson and Isaiah Trunk, the latter of whom felt compelled to further research the phenomenon of these Jewish councils, the Judenrat, the Jewish ghetto councils. Why did he do this? He published a massive book in order to disprove Hannah Arendt's allegations. Of course, Arendt defended herself, but she did not get the better of the debate. I think this is not a minority view, but nowadays, of course, her star has risen, and it's not that many people know about Marie Sirkin and those who opposed her. From trying to save the Jews during the war, Sirkin, as editor of Jewish Frontier, turned after Germany's surrender to refugee rescue, then to protecting Israel from Arab armies, Soviet anti-Zionists, American isolationists, and State Department so-called realists, and from old-fashioned anti-Semites who attacked Israel's legitimacy. The war over history had replaced the war in history. I have to confess to finding Marie Sirkin's polemical powers somewhat less admirable when she turned on fellow Zionists who were not labor Zionists. As the revisionist movement under Jabotinsky began to gain strength in the late 1920s, she referred to him as the Führer, and later wrote venomously about his disciple, Menachem Begin, who was eventually Prime Minister of Israel. Rather than credit the unquestionable contributions of the Jewish underground to the struggle against the British in Palestine, she remained disappointingly partisan to those who would have expected from her deeper understanding of both the limits of socialism for a robust economy and the need for a strong military in a modern democratic Jewish state. In an otherwise highly favorable review of her collected essays under the title The State of the Jews, Julius Weinberg asks how someone so precise in her analyses of Arab hostility, of Western passivity, and Soviet mendacity could have signed on to the 1980 petition of the American Friends of Peace Now that named the Begin government's policy of settlement on the West Bank as the critical obstacle to peace in the Middle East. He writes, "One possible but unlikely explanation for this surprising act would be that Ms. Sirkin has changed her mind on the fundamental issue of Israel's position in the Middle East, or on the equally fundamental issue of Arab intentions. A more plausible explanation would have to take into account the shifts on the Israeli political landscape, and especially the replacement of the ruling Labor Party by the Likud in 1977. So I shared Weinberg's disappointment at the time, but perhaps this is asking too much of someone who could not imagine Israel in any form other than the labor Zionism that she had been born into. Independent thinker though she certainly was, she spent many years in the organizational, ideological part of the movement where factional loyalty is assumed. This is worth including in a tribute to the work of Marie Sirkin, since the pattern keeps repeating itself. And if she could temporarily subordinate defense of Israeli sovereignty to promotion of one of its factions, I think it could happen to anyone. So happily, when Brandeis University was established in 1948, the same year as the Jewish state, she was invited to become the professor of literature that she had initially aspired to be. She was among the first to develop courses in American Jewish literature, and I met Marie Sirkin once in the late 1970s, and when she heard that I was a Canadian teacher of literature, she asked me, "Do you know Crackpot?" which was the recently published novel by Adele Wiseman that was, none of my literary acquaintances had yet read this book, which is really an astonishing book. If you think you know what North American Jewish literature is like, you should read Crackpot, and just for something completely different. But she obviously, Marie Serkin, had a scholar's ambition to know everything in the field. And I was struck, very struck, by how intelligent was her appreciation of this intriguing and very quirky book. So Marie's collected essays, The State of the Jews, remind us of something to know about history. It is seldom written by those who make it, and it is only known thanks to those who write it. Since the Bible, Jews have not always been overly fortunate in their historians. Some, like Josephus, joined the other side. Others, like Emanuel Ringelblum in the Warsaw Ghetto, never survived to complete his task. Marie was an intellectual, freewheeling writer, witness to her age, who fully understood the privilege of witnessing the resurrection of Israel. She was both a participant in the process and its trustworthy scribe. And I would say, blessed is the eternal flame that she kept alight. Thank you.